Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the influential but sometimes forgotten women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. First, I have to explain my extremely long absence. The last episode was in February, which seems like forever ago. Since that time, my husband has come back from Korea, but is still gone on a temporary duty assignment for a short while longer. And my daughters and I packed up one house. Well, we packed up part of it, and the movers packed up the other part. Drove two cars and a trailer full of stuff across the country. Our new house at our new duty station is unpacked, the computers are hooked up, and the youngest is registered for school and all her activities, so here we are, ready to go again. My books have been calling out to me from the shelves saying, make your kids crazy, talking to them about history. So they were really pleased to see me pick these up again. Just a warning, my first topic back is a little racy in parts, so if you're listening with your kids, I do say a word or two that you may not want them asking grandma about, so be warned. I will also say that I am not including some obvious themes in the podcast, namely some racism and prohibition. It'll make more sense in a few minutes. These topics deserve their own time, so they will be on our list for future podcasts. Today's question is this: what is all this flap about the flapper? She is certainly not a forgotten part of history, but I do think that sometimes her origins and daily life are overlooked when we think about the 1920s. There's definitely no question that she's a history's hottie whose style is emulated today. Believe it or not, child labor laws from the 1910s actually influenced the young people in the 20s. Who didn't have to work. For the first time, except for the poorest of homes, children in the 1920s spent their years in school to include high school and perhaps college, exploring their dreams and ambitions, and this became the norm. Their life became more the norm than before. You know, my grandparents quit school to go to work, and that was pretty normal at the time. And even during the 1920s in parts of the country, that was still normal. But in certain parts of the country, but there were so many kids now who were able to spend their time in school and then they had free time after school. This was such a new concept. But they had it and they used it well. So when this generation became young adults, their Victorian parents, who had created a comforting home where mom focused her attention on them, were shocked with all sorts of modern ideas such as shorter skirts and, shock of all shocks, talk of sex. Now, let's not think that they were modern thinking by today's standards, but for the day, these kids and the way they thought were revolutionary. Young women were going to college, but often, instead of taking that time seriously to study and develop intellectually, they were enjoying the freedom of being unmarried in a scholarly environment with other groups of young people away from their families. Apparently, wearing flat shoes was a sign of seriousness then, just as it can be today. And as Gail Collins says, the women who were feminists before this period were pushing for a cause of some sort, like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, though not all of them with bar smashing like Carrie Nation, but like the women working in the settlement houses attempting to make their cities a better place. Now the quote-unquote feminists wanted rights, but they also wanted to be able to enjoy life like the young men of the same age. This woman wanted to date, and she considered a prolific dating life a testament to her attractiveness, but she also wanted to be able to hang out in mixed groups without being considered improper by her elders. Female professors of the age were frustrated with the young women who they believed did not care about making strides for women in academia, and they were not totally incorrect because their students believed that the female academics were, and I'm quoting here, withered, bitter man-haters who were warping their charges with artificial standards of bygone feminists. It's kind of funny to think of somebody in the 1920s calling the women of the late 1800s and early 1900s who had made strides breaking into the male academic world as bygone feminists, but they did. So we have the attitude of freedom, education reform, and more modern industrial development. And I have to add here that one of those antiquated feminists was Jane Addams, the noted reformist. So the flapper was willing to insult and dismiss some really very accomplished women in her new, you know, with her new attitude of freedom, education reform, and in living in a more modern industrial world. We have all seen the pictures of the flapper, but what exactly were her trademarks? Her hemline was at the knee. Sometimes she rolled her stockings down to show her bare leg. Her arms showed, and she did not wear a corset. The cut of her dress was straight, so not body-hugging, but still shocking for the day. The reason for this was to de-emphasize the hip and the breast area. Smaller was better, and if a girl was so unfortunate as to be well-endowed, she would actually bind her breasts. Gail Collins cites a survey in her book from Milwaukee in 1927 where 1,300 girls were asked if they were wearing a corset, and only 70 of them were. The flapper was supposed to be fun and bold, and if she wasn't in college, she was likely working, and she had several new career choices, and she had close friends that were being bold with her. Of course, the two newest careers were clerical and sales work, and I have to say that I was shocked to find out that Cheaper by the Dozen, which is the namesake of but bears little resemblance to the movie with Steve Martin and Bonnie Hunt, was actually a book by the daughters of Frank Gilbreth, who had come of age during this period. His daughters did. Apparently, the name Cheaper by the Dozen came from the answer Frank used to give every time people asked why he and his wife had so many children, and he would tell them that they are cheaper by the dozen, which is quite witty, I have to say. But anyway, Anne Gilbreth, one of the daughters, says that her parents let her buy silk stockings begrudgingly, like many parents. But when she showed up to the dinner table with her hair in a bob, she says her mother dropped the peas and burst into tears. Even funnier now is the manager of the Palm Garden in New York, who said that when he rented a hall to a radical women's group, the woman who rented the room was well-dressed and drove a nice car, but if he had known she had short hair, he would have refused her, so I guess she must have been wearing a hat when she came in to rent the room. Most traditionalists gave it their best fighting against these new styles. The Ohio legislature attempted to pass a law requiring women to wear a skirt reaching the instep of the foot. And in the most disturbing of twists, according to Gail Collins, the head of the tuberculosis sanatorium actually proclaimed that wearing short skirts led to TB. However, when the mothers of these girls began to adopt some of the fashions of the flapper, staying young by dyeing her hair and wearing makeup, the fight was completely lost. The advertising of the era was full of mixed messages about being feminine and audacious at the same time. And there was just, you know, nothing else that could be done. Sorry, Ohio legislature of the 1920s. But back to the new careers of these young women. The flapper was working in an office or a storefront instead of a factory. Now, lest we believe that women were beginning to climb the corporate ladder, these new careers as secretaries, clerks, and saleswomen were being taken over by women, but the shift was specific and purposeful. These careers offered young women a chance to be working girls, but ladylike in the public sphere. She was helping other women to dress like women, or working in a work area purposefully separated from the male workers so as not to be a distraction to the men in the office, while working as sort of a pseudo-wife helpmate to her boss, keeping a schedule, running errands for his wife and children, and balancing this checkbook. Which actually brought up a funny discussion in our household. Sitcoms over the last few years have made jokes about the quote-unquote work wife. And as I was reading some research on this topic from Sarah Evans, she mentioned a movie from 1930 called The Office Wife. So I had to read more about this movie. Apparently, the movie was based on a book by a woman named Faith Baldwin. The whole story is this love triangle where the secretaries fall in love with the boss falls in love with one of the secretaries, and the wife, who is ignored by the boss, who spends all his time with this beautiful woman he works with every day, has an affair and leaves the husband. So the perils of men and women working together were clearly the central theme of the story. Yet companies were totally willing to flaunt the beauty of these young women in these offices by placing them in the front rooms on display for the male businessmen coming through the office. So even though the perils were really, really kind of clearly in the forefront of the minds of people in the time, they're certainly willing to, make the women objects for the good of the company. Also, it was not uncommon for girls still living at home to be required to turn over paychecks to their parents, so not completely free. However, referring back to earlier in the podcast, for many of our flappers going to college, these were women who broke into different professions, such as medicine and politics, but this was not the norm of the day. We do hear through the first discussion of women who wanted both career and family, we do hear, I guess, I'm sorry, through this discussion of women who wanted both career and family. And since the grand push of the mid-1800s that had standardized the ideal home with the mother in it, the idea that a woman might want to be a professional person and a mom at the same time was really, really radical. This wasn't a working class family. This was a, you know, a middle to upper class family. Working class families had largely lived outside that middle class norm with the mom home, but suddenly there were middle class women wanting to do the same. I do want to say that often when the subject is discussed, if an alien being landed on this planet in the 1920s, they would believe that the idea of a woman working was some transformative new movement in the United States. But again, why I spent so much time on Catherine Beecher and the cult of domesticity at the beginning of this podcast was to really lay out that idea and when it came about. Because during the foundation of this country, the family home and the business were, even if the business was not farming, often one and the same. So husbands and wives often worked as a team, dividing tasks, and mothers helped to earn an income while also tending to their brood if they didn't have an older daughter, mother, or aunt to help them with the children. So women contributing to the family income and having a more equal stake emotionally in the survival of the family was not a new concept in the early 1920s. So even as a stay-at-home mom myself, I feel the need to remind people of that when this subject comes up, that this Victorian ideal hadn't always been the norm in our society or any society for that sake. So, it's always something good to remember. Outside the offices, but still in the public sphere, the world of reform that had been so important to young women just a few years before morphed into a legal battle. In 1921, the National Women's Party began going from state to state working on equal rights bills, and the long road for the ERA began. The argument still existed that women would bring a, quote, nurturing sensibility and reforming vision to the political arena, unquote, and did not give up reforming living conditions for the poor and working class women and children, but the focus did turn more to the state and national legal reforms over women's leagues. The argument over what was considered women's issues versus national issues was thrust into the forefront, as well as what was the actual responsibility of the state and federal government versus the responsibility of local citizens, and sort of on the city level. Doctors took over medical care of women as government pushed women out of the women's healthcare business. So instead of women gathering together during births to give support to the birthing mother, she was separated from everyone she knew in a hospital, even though less babies died through the old methods of natural birthing with a midwife. I will say, though, the concept of a woman having pain medication during labor was really taking shape now. I guess there were pills that you could that the mother could take to basically put her to sleep, and then she would, you know, I guess she was sort of in a twilight where she didn't remember anything, but then she would wake up after. And another, I guess during the, this is the time when more women were using ether. They were breathing in ether while they were giving birth. So, you know, it's a whole different concept of giving birth. Settlement houses became bureaucratic and trained social workers took over the settlement houses. So women were not spending as much time living among the communities they were helping to become a known and trusted entity to the families in the neighborhood. So modernization was not all it was cracked up to be. The female world, which had given women a safe space to be together and protect one another, had broken down with modernity. So women were breaking into the public sphere in larger numbers while their private sphere was eroding, sort of the good with the bad. Again, every time we have a change in society, that doesn't necessarily mean every single piece of it is going to be positive. You know, some is and some isn't. The differences in the marriage market and the sexualization of marriage and the limitations to free behavior and the ability to marry were really huge in during this period. Now, before I broach the subject, I have to warn you listeners that this is the part of the podcast that's a bit racy, but I believe it is a major development in society at the time. So if you have young children listening, now might be the time to pause until later. These bold new girls of the 1920s who wanted to be pals to their male friends were also spending a fair amount of time in the backseat of automobiles. In fact, there was one quote that I read that talked about the automobile was one of the promoters of sexual behavior, one of the biggest promoters of sexual behavior in this era, even maybe more than the short skirts. Even the nice girls engaged in heavy petting, pretty much everything short of intercourse, which was a definite sign of the changing times. Social biographers wrote with fair certainty that the mothers were unaware of the behavior of their unmarried daughters. Yet when a girl did get married, she was expected to understand sex, which was a vast difference from the expectations on the wedding nights of their mothers. Freud had been written about over and over again, so the idea that a woman would enjoy sex was now pretty widely accepted. Men no longer thought it was shameful to marry a girl who wasn't a virgin. And on a positive note, the proclivity to visit a prostitute lessened when girls their own age were available for sex. Sex was no longer believed to drain a part of the limited energy from a woman that she might need for other activities. So, which was really a strange belief at the time, but since that false belief was let go, it sort of changed the idea of what a woman was capable of. Birth control was becoming more prevalent. And according to Amy Sark from the University of Pennsylvania, the major forms of birth control at the time were diaphragms, which you could apparently buy at some department stores, contraceptive douches, which I don't really know the reliability of, even though I'm pretty sure that in the Forsyte saga, that was the method Irene used to keep from having Soames children, with the same type of tube contraption and pump that was advertised at the time to end early pregnancy. And then, of course, the big one, condoms. Attracting a man was not all about a dowry, but about love and companionship, and now sexual attraction itself. By the way, I didn't forget the sort of the age-old methods that people have been using. I'm just talking about the type of birth control that people actually purchase to use. Female sexuality was used in advertisements. Magazines taught women how to catch a man. The other articles taught women how to keep a man, alluding to sexual availability in the marriage, but not actually coming out and saying that. Gloria Swanson's character in one movie, her husband left her, only to come back when she made the transformation from flapper to flapper from frumpy housewife. But on the flip side, a woman who did get married was not a burden to, a woman, I'm sorry, a woman who did not get married was not a burden to her parents anymore. She was just considered to be missing out on the opportunity for an intimate relationship, and society now admitted that this intimate relationship should exist in a marriage. Still no admission that some people didn't feel the need for traditional marriage for this type of relationship, but still, again, quite a change in thinking. A great stride at the time was that maternity clothes became commonplace and pregnant women were no longer expected to stay home. However, having a baby was still quite dangerous. According to Gail Collins, during World War I, more women still died from the effects of childbirth than men in the battlefield. Doctors understood germs, but they still lacked the tools to deal with sepsis and major diseases. So the housewife often had electricity and a phone, as well as bleach to clean her indoor bathroom, which, by the way, many of the British still lacked at the time. But her child was still could possibly die from lurking diseases that were common at the time. One of the diseases specifically mentioned right after World War I was, of course, the major influenza outbreak that happened right after that. So she might have electricity and all these seeming modern conveniences, but yet she still completely feared her child, getting the flu. She might have a vacuum cleaner, electric iron, toaster, and washing machine. Ads said that the housewife could leave the home to do things like play golf because electricity cleaned her house. Now, we all know that's not really the case, but it did make it easier for the average housewife to keep house without hired help. And by the way, don't think that I'm belittling the fact that still today, people do die from diseases like the flu. It's just that it's not in the forefront of your mind, when your children get this, where at the time it certainly was. In fact, I remember my grandmother talking about her mother, right about that time, scrubbing walls and washing their curtains once a week to keep them free from disease. She would scrub everything in the house because she was petrified that her children were going to get one of the diseases that was going around in the mill village that some of the other children had. Smoking had existed in the recesses of the private home for years, but now women felt free to smoke in public. There were still those who considered this unladylike behavior, but ads told the flapper that she could keep her thin, boyish figure if she would smoke. Dieting became fashionable. Cereal became the normal breakfast, and a sandwich became the lunch of choice, where their mothers had sat for meals at a more formal table. The house was not the only thing more amiable in a woman's life. Early cars really required a lot of strength to operate, but the newer Model T was actually advertised to women who could now drive their children to lessons and run to the store all dressed in their kneeling skirt like their teenage daughters. Women of all ages began to show their outdoor spirit with a tan. Tennis outfits got skimpier when Helen Willis said she could play easier in that type of clothing, and bathing suits got smaller and smaller. Intercollegiate female sports were born, but some schools sort of resisted this movement and had play days for light sporting, which they considered more feminine. Of course, when Gertrude Ederle successfully swam the English Channel, she showed that women could display physical endurance, which inspired women all over the world to follow suit. So, you know, the world really was changing. Tans and sporting, you know, would never have been considered just 30 years previously. So when we think about the flapper, we might think of a woman in the 1920s who went to clubs and danced after her day of working as a store clerk or stenographer. She seemed light and gay to the outside world, and she felt like she could speak her mind. Her legs and arms showed, and she bobbed her hair, but that was not all she was. The flapper wanted to be equal to a man, but enjoy life like a woman. She wanted to have fun, but she knew she was still expected to marry. She was sexually exploited, but she also used her sexuality to her advantage. She was a new kind of girl, and she was fabulous. So thank you, flappers of the world, for the early Cyndi Lauper and all of you. Girls do just want to have fun. And that is our podcast for today. You know, and it's funny because I had to think about my email for a minute because it's been so long since I've done a podcast and so long since I've signed off. But if you have any questions, comments, or just anything to say about history, please feel free to email me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's just historieshotties, HISTORYSHOTTIES@yahoo.com. So until next time.